Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us for this Quantum to Cosmos Festival presentation. My name is Michael Duchesne. I'm Chief Operating Officer at Perimeter Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome all of you who are in the theater here at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and also a very warm welcome to everybody joining us on the net around the world. Just a few little pieces of housekeeping before we begin. I'd like to ask all of you in the theater to please turn off your cell phones and BlackBerries. On the other hand, people at home, please do use your BlackBerries. Kindly share news of this presentation and our entire festival by emailing your friends and colleagues. Email them our link, q2cfestival.com, so that they can share in the festival as well. They can also follow us on Twitter at q2cfestival, and please remember to use the hashtag q2c. We have a number of great sponsors for this festival, and I'd like to acknowledge tonight Bennett Jones, who is very generously sponsoring tonight's lecture. It's now my great pleasure to introduce your host for this session, Jennifer Ouellette. Jennifer is a reformed English major who has fallen in love with science, has written two books, including The Physics of Buffyverse, and is now the director of the Science and Entertainment Exchange. Jennifer fields phone calls from Ridley Scott and Kenneth Branagh when they have science questions. She's here tonight to guide us to an understanding of the state of the universe. Please join me in welcoming Jennifer Ouellette.
Thanks very much for that introduction. I'm here to introduce our distinguished panel of speakers. We have Lawrence Krauss, Katie Fries, and Neil Turok. Let me tell you a little bit about them for those at home who might not be familiar with them. Lawrence Krauss is director of the Origins Initiative and a professor of physics at Arizona State University. He's the author of many best-selling popular books, including my personal favorite, The Physics of Star Trek. And he does research at the interface between elementary particle physics and cosmology. Katie Fries is a physicist at the University of Michigan. She specializes in dark matter and inflationary models. Particularly, she's trying to come up with a model of the early universe that basically fits the data at the time of the Big Bang or right after the Big Bang. And she admitted to me yesterday that she had a slight crush on Captain Kirk when she was growing up, which I thought was charming. And finally, we have someone who's probably known to many of you, Neil Turok. He is director of the Perimeter Institute. He is co-author of a book with Paul Steinhardt called Endless Universe, which discusses his theory of the cyclic universe, which we'll probably be discussing tonight. So please give me a warm welcome for our speakers. The title of this is The State of the Universe, and I think a good place to start is the state of our current universe. I think it's fair to say that we're coming off a golden age of cosmology, particularly since the early 1900s. And I would like to hear from each of you what you think some of the big breakthroughs have been over the last 100 years, so we get a state of where we are, a sense of where we are, and then from there we'll jump into what we don't know and talk about some of the current exciting research going on. So I guess we can start with Neil.
It's extraordinary how far we've come in the last 100 years. If you compare it to exploring the surface of the Earth, it wasn't so long ago where Africa, the continent I'm from, was opened up and mapped. This was in the late 19th century. And then shortly after that, just 30 years or so in the 20s, we understood for the first time that our galaxy is not the only one in the universe, and that all the blotches in the sky were actually clumps of stars, and thought to be clumps of stars actually turned out to be other galaxies. And so there are at least 100 billion galaxies which we can see in the sky. So we discovered we lived in this huge universe. But I think the most exciting developments have been in the last 10 years when, for the first time, the entire visible universe was mapped. And we now have pictures taking us right back to 300,000 years after the Big Bang and revealing everything we could possibly see with visible light. And so this is an age of discovery, unlikely to be repeated or improved on for a very long time.
Katie?
I think I've been very lucky to be working in cosmology in this heyday in the past decade and also in the next decade or two. The amount of information we've been getting is just mind-boggling. And if you contrast this with 100 years ago, so at the time Einstein wrote down his theory of general relativity in 1915, as you were saying, people didn't even realize that there was anything outside the Milky Way. So Messier made measurements and was irritated because he wanted to study comets. There were all these cloudy things in the way, these nebula that annoyed him. Well, those were other galaxies. In fact, we now call it the Messier catalog of galaxies. So if you compare that state of the universe to how much we know now, it's just mind-boggling.
And, well, okay, I was trying to think of what I'd add to you guys. What amazes me, actually, is one of the few facts of science that's actually sunk in to the public, and there are very few, as far as I can tell, is the fact the universe had a beginning. That is also something that was not known 100 years ago. In fact, the conventional scientific wisdom was that the universe was static and eternal. It led Einstein to do some things. And that is a remarkable fact, because that really... Everyone knows the universe had a beginning. Some people in Texas think it was 6,000 years ago, but the rest of the world, well, not entirely the rest of the world, but we now know it's exactly, we now know it's 13.72 billion years ago, and we could say that last decimal place with a straight face, which is also amazing. And that changed our picture of our understanding of ourselves and our place in the universe. That is one of the, I think, major impacts on the human condition that cosmology has had. Now, of course, the revolutions that Neil was talking about, and Katie to some extent, in the last decade, primarily the fact, the astounding fact, that most of the universe is made up, the dominant energy in the universe is an empty space, something we have no understanding of whatsoever, has not only changed our picture of the present, but has also changed our picture of the future, and I expect that that may eventually sink in. So it's had, it really has had an impact, I think, on human culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what we know so far is we know how old the universe is, we know what it's made of, we know how much it weighs, which amazed me, because how do you get a scale big enough to weigh the universe? In fact, I actually would like you to maybe, any of you who feels comfortable, to tell the audience a little bit about how do we know these things, because you can't weigh the universe on a big scale, so how do you know?
Oh, well, I don't know. Okay, I'll start, or we could all start.
We can reverse this time.
I don't know. I'll tell you a little bit, and then we can each do it, because we can all add onto this, I guess. We use gravity. I mean, the way you weigh things is with gravity, and over the period of the last 100 years, we've used gravity in different ways to weigh things. The way, in fact, what people don't realize is that's the way we weigh the Earth. We can't put the Earth on a scale. Or in a turtle on the back of turtles, but we use gravity. We use the speed of the moon around the Earth and our knowledge of the strength of gravity to weigh the Earth. It's the best way we determine the weight of the Earth. It's the way we determine the weight of the Sun, and it was it's the way we determine the weight of our galaxy by looking at the motion of the Sun around galaxies. We use gravity in a more sophisticated way now. We use general relativity to weigh clusters of galaxies and in the universe on larger scales. And I'll stop there because I'm sure my colleagues here want to add some stuff, maybe. I don't know.
Well, answering both questions at the same time. So also at the time of general relativity, the people who applied these ideas that mass and energy are related to the geometry of the universe came up with the notion that there are three possible geometries for the universe. So it could be either a flat universe, flat in the sense of eighth grade math working, no curvature required, or the other two shapes were a spherical universe, or if you can imagine, a saddle. And even when I was in graduate school, the idea that we would answer which of these is correct was thought to be far-fetched. So if you think back, the people who made these propositions were really working in the blue. For all they knew, this was science fiction. Mm-hmm. And here it was at the turn of the millennium. I think this was an absolute major breakthrough that this question was answered. And this addresses weighing the universe because the way we were able to understand the total mass and energy content of the universe was by actually measuring the geometry. So light beams of photons that you see from way back in the history of the universe, they were found to move on straight lines. If the universe were curved, those would have been curved lines. And it took balloon experiments at the South Pole, as well as the WMAP, Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe satellite. These are very expensive missions to put satellites in space to answer these questions. And this was at around the turn of the millennium. So that's a really big deal, and we weighed the universe as a whole that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let me expand on something Larry said. We use gravity to weigh the universe, so one of the most fundamental questions in physics is, what is the vacuum? And the vacuum is very far from empty. We've known this from quantum physics, that the picture of the vacuum is not that it's just empty space, but it actually contains virtual particles and fields of all types, and there's a virtual me and a virtual you fluctuating in and out of existence in the vacuum.
And then annihilating.
And in fact, that's how the particles we're made of, protons and neutrons, are held together, is by the fluctuations in the vacuum. So the vacuum is a very wonderful thing. It contains everything possible in nature in a virtual form. But the energy of the vacuum is something we had very little information on. And in fact, it turns out the only way to measure the energy of the vacuum is through gravity. Because all other physics, the energy in the vacuum is there in the beginning and it's there at the end. And so if you do some calculation, you just subtract it out and you can't change the energy in the vacuum. So, but gravity responds to the energy in the vacuum. And if you say, what is our best chance of measuring the energy in the vacuum? Obviously, you want the biggest piece of vacuum you can find, because then it'll have the most energy and the gravitational effect will be as big as possible. So what do? You map the whole universe. You take the whole visible universe and see how fast is it expanding now and how fast was it expanding in the past, because we receive radiation coming to us today that was emitted 13.7 billion years ago. So we can actually map the history of the expansion of the universe by looking at light coming from further and further away. And what this tells us is that the energy of the vacuum is not zero. This was a massive surprise in the late 1990s. Actually, I know a paper of Larry's written, I believe, in 1990 or 91 with Michael Turner. Which none of us believed.
No. I thought you were wrong.
Well, we thought we were wrong, too.
Well, so most of his ideas were wrong. But on this one, he was right. And so they were playing around with models of the universe, which is what we do as theorists. And they said, what if the vacuum energy was positive? And this would resolve various of the problems that the standard Big Bang theory had in fitting the data. And it turned out just a very few years later that this was confirmed. And so this is still a very mysterious fact of the universe, why the energy of the vacuum is not quite zero, but it's probably of very fundamental importance.
It's the biggest mystery in science, in my opinion. And by the way, it's changed something, to pick up on something Katie said. The holy grail of cosmology for much of the 20th century was to figure out which of these universes we live in that Katie talked about, open, closed, or flat. In fact, the reason I, as a particle physicist, got into cosmology is I wanted to be the first person to know how the universe would end. It seemed like a good idea. And that was really coming from weighing the universe. But the interesting thing, one of the interesting things, is that that was completely misplaced. Because now that we know empty space has energy, it changes all the rules. And we used to say in books, and I've written books saying it, that a closed universe would collapse and an open universe would expand forever. But now that we know that this energy of empty space can exist and we don't know anything about it, we know that it's possible for an open universe to collapse and a closed universe to expand forever. So having learned finally that the universe is flat, which is a really major effort, it doesn't tell us anything about the future.
That, I think, is one of the most wonderful things about cosmology. I mean, Neil, you mentioned the fact that you come up with these crazy models and you test them and you have no idea. You might actually think they're wrong and they end up being right. Yeah. And this actually ties into what we've been talking about, the energy of the vacuum and what the universe is made of. In 1998, 1999, there was this incredible discovery that the universe While it is still expanding, and that was something that Edwin Hubble had found earlier on in the last century, it's actually accelerating in its expansion. And that, again, changes the picture. And I know you've written about this, Lawrence, so why don't you take this and run with it, and the rest of you can jump in.
Well, I mean, Neil and Katie Verde talked a little bit about it, but as what I said is, this, is that this major discovery was that, which we predicted.
Don't be modest.
And we're exactly right about, but anyway,
so
that's okay.
So,
but,
so did Einstein.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah, Einstein did too, and he called it his biggest blunder, in fact. And his biggest blunder was thinking that he blundered, in fact. But it is, he didn't think of it in terms of the modern way we think about it. He added this constant to make a static universe. In fact, as I said, Einstein, he thought when he developed general relativity, that the universe was static, and the problem with gravity is it sucks, and it always pulls, it never pushes, and therefore you couldn't have a static universe in Newtonian gravity or in general relativity because the stars and galaxies would eventually collapse together. So he added this extra term, which would produce this universal repulsion. He didn't know it had anything to do with energy at that time. He added it by hand, and in fact, it was a mathematical error as well. But in fact, very shortly afterwards, we realized the universe is expanding, and you don't need that, because gravity can be universally attractive if the universe is expanding. And the big question was, will that expansion end or not? And what we have discovered, in fact, as Neil was just saying, is that empty space, in fact, has energy, and when you give empty space energy, it produces something that looks just like Einstein's cosmological constant, and it is, in fact, causing not just that expansion, but the acceleration. And one of the many implications, and I guess I'll talk about this here tomorrow, in fact, is that the future is, as we look out, the longer we wait, the less we'll see. Because the galaxies are moving away from us, and they're speeding up, and eventually, they'll be moving away from us faster than the speed of light, which some of you can ask about, because it sounds like it violates the law of physics, but it doesn't. And then they'll disappear. And so the future will be vastly different because of that.
Mm-hmm. So we better study that stuff now. Is what
you're saying. I've been using it to try and get Congress to fund it, but they don't seem to care.
So we've been talking about this remarkable revolution, even a paradigm shift of the dark energy. I wanted to tell the audience about the observation, how it happened. So people looked at supernovae, which are the bright explosions of dying stars. And these are objects we think we understand very well, and so they are standard candles. In other words, we think we know how bright they really are. So when you look at very distant ones, you can go and see, well, how bright are they compared to what your theory tells you they should look like? And by making that comparison, people realized, oh my God, they're dimmer than they should be, and the natural explanation is they're accelerating away from us. So the universe not only is expanding, which we have known since 1929, but it appears that this expansion is speeding up, it's accelerating. So it's as though someone in the back seat held up a 60-watt light bulb. I know that is a 60-watt light bulb, but whoa, it's looking really faint. That guy's running away from me. So,
and in fact, you know, to touch on that, you said, how do we weigh the universe? That's the easy part. The hard part is what Katie just talked about. That's been the hard part of cosmology for most of the 20th century, is measuring distances, because we don't have these long tape measures. Weighing mass is easy, because you can use gravity, but distance requires something like a standard candle. And that has been the problem, and it's taken 80 years to really try and get that right, we hope.
Mm-hmm. So what does dark energy tell us about the fate of our universe? Because that was the answer you wanted to know how the universe is going to end. And the implications are it's just going to be this cold, dark, lonely place.
it's as I would say, so it implies we live in the worst of all possible universes to live in. So much for intelligent design. But it really means the future is dismal and bleak in every way you can think about, and as I say, I'll spend a lot of time, I hope a whole lecture tomorrow talking about it, but it not only will the rest of the universe disappear, all information about what's going on will disappear, and we've argued that, in fact, life must end in such a universe, and any civilization can't
survive
forever. All
right, now, Laura, you know I disagree with this one.
Jump right in, Katie.
That's why I mentioned it, Katie, because I thought it might cause that.
So, if it's a cosmological constant, the idea that Einstein originally introduced, then I agree with you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and we don't know.
But if it's some kind of vacuum that changes with time, mm-hmm. then you can still sneak in some existence. We don't have to overheat. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's the important part. So we don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know that this energy we're measuring now. We see the universe accelerating now, but because we don't understand it at all, it makes no sense. Yeah. We don't know if it's the energy of empty space or just something that is behaving like the energy of empty space. And so Katie's absolutely correct. If it's something different, the rules are different, and I still think the future is dismal, but that's for different people.
I do have to add, I was in New Scientist, they wrote an article about this, saying, while Will Kinney and Catherine Fries may not look much like superheroes, they may just have saved the fate of life in the universe. So I had to add that. But anyway.
That's actually a good quote. That actually anticipated my next question, was we don't really know what the dark energy is. It's really the biggest question in physics. We have no idea. We think it might be related to the vacuum energy and the cosmological constant. Perhaps one of you can talk about what some of the other alternatives are and the implications.
So I put forward one theory of it, which is attempting to resolve its magnitude. So the most puzzling thing about it is it's actually an incredibly small number. So one way to think of this within the standard picture of cosmology is you have the Big Bang, which is a very mysterious event where everything in the world sprang into existence, apparently for no reason at all, and at very huge density. So just think about three-dimensional space suddenly filling with a huge density of matter and radiation. And expanding very rapidly. And then you've got to put into that mix a tiny amount of dark energy, or cosmological constants, if you want Einstein's picture. And the amount you have to put in is about one part in a Google. That's 0.000 with 100 zeros and then one. That's the fraction of dark energy present near just after the Big Bang. So that dark energy is completely irrelevant to the behavior of the universe at early times, where the matter and the radiation dominate the density. The universe expands, gravity responds to the radiation, and then the matter and radiation dilute away and become spread out across space. And then about 5 billion years after the Big Bang, the matter and radiation are so dilute that you start to see that tiny amount of dark energy that was present in the beginning, because it does not dilute. The dark energy does not dilute away as the universe expands. So that's the standard picture. You have to explain this number of 100 zeros, 0.100 zeros with a one. You have to explain that in any theory of the beginning of the universe. So our point of view is quite different. Maybe the presence of this dark energy is telling us that this picture of the universe beginning with special initial conditions set by, you know, God knows whom, maybe that picture is wrong. Mm-hmm. And maybe these two puzzles, that the beginning of the universe is completely mysterious and the end of it is equally mysterious, maybe these are linked. And so in our model, what happens is that the dark energy, in fact, does not last forever. It decays. And its decay causes the next Big Bang. And so the condition of today's universe actually sets the scene for the next one. And in such a model, you can show that it's possible for the dark energy to it's a cyclical model. There's a bang followed by matter and radiation, dark energy. Dark energy decays, makes the next bang. This continues for a very long time. And over the course of it, it's possible for the dark energy to gradually relax to this very, very tiny number that we see today.
So this is the big bounce model, kind of like a bouncing ball.
Yes.
Perhaps you can clarify me what happens to us, because that's really what we all care about. You know, in this model, does the universe collapse back down to a singularity and then have another big bang? How does the dark energy affect that?
Yeah. So what happens to us is that at the singularity, the full symmetry underlying the laws of physics is revealed. And so this is something particle physicists have been exploring at big accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider. When you go to very high energies, it's like you're building a microscope able to probe tiny distances. And at these very high energies, we see more and more symmetry in the laws of physics. The mathematics, this sort of essence of the laws, is revealed more and more. And there's no higher energy than the Big Bang itself. And so the idea then is that at the singularity, the full symmetry of the laws of physics is revealed, and in particular, all the particles we're made of become massless. All their mass goes away, and this means they all move at the speed of light. And in a sense, everything becomes the same particle, and everything's moving at the speed of light. So the bang itself is this wonderful event in which we are broken up into our fundamental constituents.
One with
it's
the
wonderful
universe.
Depending upon your perspective. we need to put kind of a
new age spin on it and say we become one with the universe.
Yes, we do.
We already are one with the universe. I want to point that out.
Yeah.
You want to point that out now, or
well, I mean, we are. I think the other night we talked about that. We are star children. All the atoms in your bodies come from the very supernovae that Katie was talking about. Not those supernovae, but ones in our galaxy. Every atom in your body came from an exploding star, and you really are therefore are connected to the cosmos. And you wouldn't be here because the carbon, the nitrogen, the oxygen, the iron, all the things that are important weren't created in the Big Bang. They were created in the nuclear furnaces in the center of stars. And the only way they could get out is if those stars exploded. So they died so that you could be here today, about 200 million of them, in fact, in our galaxy over the last 10 billion years or so. I want to jump on one thing that Neil said.
Sure.
Neil's model, which is really the cyclic model, is very appealing philosophically to many people because they don't like a universe that has a beginning.
And like a depressing end to the story.
It has a beginning, but no well-defined end. It just sort of seems to peter out. Let me just put two bits of philosophical support for that ugly universe. one is that the great discovery they've made that Katie referred to, that the universe is flat, is very appealing. It was very appealing to physicists, particle physicists in particular, beforehand, because it's really the only mathematically beautiful universe. But what's particularly mathematically beautiful about it, from my point of view, is that it means the total energy of the universe is zero, precisely zero. And that is a beautiful universe, because if you want a universe that came from nothing, then if it has zero energy, that's particularly attractive. And so a zero-energy universe, which we appear to live in, has a natural beginning from nothingness, maybe by a quantum fluctuations. And so that's one of the reasons why it's so appealing. And I think it's answered the question, and I have lots of debates with theologians, but people say, why is there something rather than nothing? And in fact, if you start out with nothing, you're guaranteed to get something in physics in some sense, because quantum fluctuations out of nothing will produce something. So that's one aspect. The other is that the other picture that's come into physics from different areas is that there are, and I'm sure we'll get to this, that there may be many universes. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of arguments, many, and even in three dimensions, not just higher dimensions. And in such a picture, the universe, it almost reproduces the static universe. Niels is the bounce universe, which people mm-hmm. have been thinking about for a while. In such a metaverse, everywhere at any time, there may be a Big Bang happening. Our universe had a specific beginning, but there's somewhere else there's a Big Bang happening now, and somewhere else there's a universe collapsing. So on its large scales, such a universe would look largely the same at all times, and that's also another sort of philosophically pleasing possibility, at least.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention a third possibility, in addition to the cosmological constant or the cyclic universes, both of which have a vacuum component to them. The other possibility is that we're missing something even more fundamental. We've got the equations completely wrong. Einstein was incomplete. So Newton's laws, beautiful, they answer every question about what's going to happen in this room. But if you want to address questions on larger scales, then general relativity becomes important. So Einstein was a modification to Newton's laws. It may be that we're in the same position yet again, that the equations that we have so far are incomplete and that we have to do something different. There's no vacuum energy in this approach. It's all matter. But we're missing something on the very large scales out to just beyond where we can see that would give us an alternative explanation for these bizarre phenomena that we're seeing.
Right. Since Neil brought up the Big Bounce and you just brought up multiverse, it seems as good as point any to the other thing that we really don't know is what happens before the Big Bang. Where did the universe come from? And there's a lot of theories going on. I'll let you guys summarize those up. But what's our state of the knowledge there, and what are we looking for? At this point, we're getting very speculative, of course. And how do we test those? And what does it mean if we can't test them?
So I think there, the fascinating thing about this is there are essentially two possibilities.
Yeah.
One is that the singularity was the beginning of the universe, the real beginning. There was just nothing before it. And the other, that it wasn't. It's as simple as that. And we have two. Furthermore, I'll tell you how this is really testable. That's the extraordinary thing. We will learn. It may take us 10 years, it may take us 50 years, but we will learn the answer to this question. So there are two theories in each camp, one of which Stephen Hawking is an advocate of. And according to his theory, time disappears at the beginning. Time, in a sense, turns into another dimension of space. That's the easiest way to explain it. So if you have a cone with a sharp tip, that the sharp tip is, in a way, a singularity. You can't describe it as a smooth surface. But you could always imagine rounding off that sharp tip. So a cone is a smooth surface. And that's essentially what Stephen does. He converts or finds a mathematical way to convert time into space, and then he rounds off the singularity. So that's one idea. It's a very beautiful mathematical idea. When you examine it in detail, unfortunately, it seems to me to predict the wrong things. It predicts an empty universe. It does not predict, a very predictive idea, but it predicts that when the universe starts, it's as empty as possible. There is no matter, there is no radiation. And so Stephen right now is struggling to try and figure his way out of this problem, and he acknowledges it's a real problem. The other possibility is the Big Bang, the singularity was not the beginning. Now that's equally difficult because you have to explain, and this is, by the way, Roger Penrose is very keen on this picture, and he's someone we've learned to take rather seriously. So Roger Penrose's idea is that before, you have to have a universe before the Big Bang, and then the Big Bang is this extremely violent event which you somehow have to get through. And mathematically, you need a set of equations which can go through the singularity. Now, obviously, Einstein's equations will not do it because the singularity is defined to be the place where Einstein equations fail. And so you need some extension of Einstein's equations, and so we've been looking at superstring theory and a theory called M theory, because it's still mysterious, and trying to figure out how to get a consistent mathematical description of passage through a singularity. And I think we're making a lot of interesting progress, but it's not resolved yet. Now, the reason why this is testable is that over the next decade, an entirely new window in the universe is going to be opened, and that is gravitational radiation. So we trust Einstein's theory enough to understand what happens when two black holes merge, or if a neutron star, which has a very strong gravitational field, falls into a black hole. And this almost certainly happens very regularly in the universe. We see evidence for black holes, and we certainly see neutron stars. So we know this happens. When these violent events happen, the gravitational waves will come through to us, and detectors now, in progress, should detect the first signals of this. It's a fairly sure bet that within the next 10 years, we will definitely see gravitational waves for the first time. If you take that one step further, these gravitational waves are sort of like X-rays that allow us to see right through the early universe, the hot matter and radiation, because the gravitational waves do not get attenuated by that stuff. The universe is transparent to gravitational waves. So when we measure them, when we're able to map the sky in gravitational waves, we'll be looking right at the Big Bang singularity, and we'll certainly be able to tell the difference between this Hawking theory or the bouncing universe theory. They give very different predictions.
Well, yeah, but we should moderate that a little bit. Because I hate to guarantee things that aren't necessarily guaranteed. We're not guaranteed. Gravitational waves, if we see them, will be an incredibly interesting probe. In fact, it's one of the areas I work in. There's no no-go theorem. It's quite possible that the level of gravitational waves may not be visible, and nature will decide. But it is indeed, I agree with Neil completely, the key probe to look back at the earliest moments, and there are different predictions. It turns out we've tried to muddy the waters. There are actually lots of different ways to produce gravitational waves, And so there may be confusion there, but if we see it, it'll be a great new probe. And every time we open a new window on the universe, we are indeed surprised. And the other thing I will say is, even independent of Stephen Hawking's picture, it's quite plausible that time itself, that the question, the way to answer the question, what happened before the Big Bang, is that it's not a good question. because the word before just may not apply, because space and time, general relativity tells us that space and time are coupled to matter and energy, and when everything is at a singularity, it could just mean that the concepts of space and time, as we think of them, break down, and you just can't use those classical concepts.
So I wanted to mention another concept that we haven't talked about yet, which is inflation. So the very earliest days of the universe may have been an extremely rapidly expanding period. The reason that these ideas came out is because it's very hard to understand the smoothness of our universe on large scales. So of course in this room, we're not homogeneous. Different people have different heads and so forth. But if you look on large enough scales, the universe on the average is really very smooth and homogeneous. And in fact, in the standard Big Bang picture, you absolutely cannot explain that. Something would have had to move at speeds faster than the speed of light. So the idea originally put forth by Alan Guth was that you had this very rapid early expansion phase where the universe just completely grows by an enormous amount, and you take a small region, which is smooth, and you blow it up to be very large. Now, one of the beauties of this picture is that it makes very definite predictions, some of which are being borne out. For example, it predicted a flat universe. It got that right. It also predicts quantum fluctuations that can explain the large-scale structure of the universe, the galaxies, the clusters, and so on. And we can probe those quantum fluctuations. Some of them, again, the measurements are coming out right. But one of the key tests will be the gravitational radiation. And so we're all really looking forward to these experiments, and I would agree with Neil, we're going to see something.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. nature sometimes makes life difficult. And in fact, I noticed Neil and I were kind of, there's one thing I would disagree with you slightly there, Katie, and that is that the simplest model of inflation predicts a flat universe. Inflation is such a robust and beautiful idea, however, that it can predict many things. And you know as well, in the old days when we thought the universe was open, there were people who built inflationary models that would predict an open universe.
So at the time, I was saying if the universe is not flat, then inflation is dead. Models were not,
many models were. In general, models were only beautiful in the eye of the model builder, but yeah. Still. But it can.
It is funny, isn't it? True?
It is funny. Yeah. So, yes, I worked on some of these models.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, the reason I worked on them was in order to show that this alleged prediction of inflation could be circumvented. So they were somewhat contrived models, which were able to produce an open universe, meaning one shaped like a saddle, out of inflation. Now, I have to say, the situation is a little more complicated than Katie is saying. Some of the, people like us work on various levels. Some people work closer to the data. Some people work as far as possible from the data. And in particular, there are some string theorists, like Lenny Susskind, for example, who is really trying to reconcile inflation with the laws of physics at the most fundamental level. And he has concluded that the most likely universe to emerge from inflation is actually very open, not a flat universe. So this is still a matter of opinion, as physics always is, without experiment. And
at the frontier, it's always, the point, we're struggling.
Of course.
Mm. And I think the thing about inflation is it's a beautiful idea, but it's not yet a beautiful model. Namely, if there were a particle physics model that just predicted it, we'd all jump on the bandwagon. It's an idea that's so compelling to explain, it's what we see, that many people believe it's true, but we don't have any fundamental particle physics model that naturally gives a beautiful picture of inflation. There are lots of different models, and Katie's made some, so we're in that stage at the edge where we just don't know. Yeah. And I think it's, applying string theory right now to this is a little premature, I would say.
Actually, one thing I maybe should emphasize, which is a surprising thing about the subject, and it constantly surprises me, that
even though, well, the first thing is that as a bunch of cosmologists, the thing we enjoy most is to disagree. We're actually not a trade union. We're not a trade union. On the contrary, the whole spirit of the field is to prove each other wrong and to find observations that'll prove somebody else's theory wrong and so on. But nevertheless, we are able to agree to an astonishing extent that when a theory has reached a certain level of beauty, simplicity, and appeal, you will find everyone says, yep, that's the leading theory. And of course, we don't believe it yet, but that's the one to focus the experiments on. That's the one to prove or disprove. And that happens. The consensus emerges in a remarkable way.
I also wanted to bring this back to, I was saying that 100 years ago, people worked on these possible universes, and for them, it was really science fiction. Nobody knew. So we're doing the same thing. We're creative. We have ideas. We're hoping it's not science fiction, but until it's tested, all you have is the beauty of the theory to go on. Our fortunate stance is that we're in the era of cosmology when experiments are making these measurements so rapidly, so we're lucky.
Right, and I actually want to just interrupt you because we have limited time. I want to move on to dark matter because this is something that is really big right now. I mean, we're actually beginning to see experimental results. Dark matter is the other component of the dark side of the universe that we don't know much about. We know more about it, I think, than dark energy, and I know, Katie, I think you have the latest. There's been a couple of experiments that have had some preliminary results, and there's some very exciting results coming up.
So to put everything that we're talking about in perspective, here's the pie picture of the universe that we have. It's 4% ordinary matter, atoms, people, walls, planets. It's only 4%. Then we've been talking about the 70%, the bulk, this really mysterious dark energy. Well, there's a quarter, the 25%, that's the dark matter, and everybody thinks it does exist, and in fact, it looks like there are measurements coming in that even papers that are going to be released next week that I think this is a problem we're putting our finger on and that we're going to nail this very soon in the next few years. So the favored candidate is the weakly interacting massive particles or WIMPs. So these things weigh about 100 times as much as a proton. But they don't have electric charge, so you can't see them. And instead, they have weak interactions, hence the name WIMP. And you have to build detectors that are sensitive to these very, very weak interactions. In the 80s, we laid out ideas. I'm a theorist, but we laid out ideas for how to do it. And there's been this ongoing effort. So if you have your nucleus of your detector, then as the WIMP comes along, it scatters off the nucleus and deposits a very small amount of energy. The goal then is to measure that energy deposit. And unfortunately, there's competition from other signals just in the atmosphere of the Earth. So you have to get rid of that stuff, you have to put your detector deep underground. And so, for example, in Sudbury, there's a mine. The Sudbury Neutrino Observatory has an underground laboratory where these experiments are being done. In the United States, in the Sudan mine, and in Europe, the Romans are putting the detector underneath the Alps. So there has been some anomalous data for 20 years now, or no, for 10 years now, coming from those kinds of experiments. But there's a different kind of experiment which is putting satellites out in space. And there are excess positrons, which are the partners of the electrons, that have been seen by the Pamela satellite. And now there are excess photons, light particles, from the Fermi satellite. And I think that there's a very good chance that these things really are due to the dark matter. And so I think we're going to nail this one.
Let me step back just one second, though, for the audience. You know, we're talking about exotic particles, and you may think, well, are we doing it just because that's what we like to do? And that's true, but also because there's a good reason. I mean, we're driven to that. It's not that we like to just think of new types of elementary particles, but from two different sides. We're driven to that because one of the most amazing things, and we don't emphasize enough how much we know about the universe and how much we can learn, including from direct laboratory data, is that we can actually, we know how many protons and neutrons there are in the universe. And that comes from looking at nuclear physics. We can understand the amount of helium in the universe and the amount of deuterium in the universe and even the amount of lithium in the universe by measuring nuclear reactions in laboratories and saying what would have happened in the early universe and predicting what there should be. And the abundance of these elements depends upon how many of the input ingredients you have, protons and neutrons. And we get this remarkable agreement between what we observe and what we predict, which tells us, in fact, how many protons and neutrons there are in the universe. And in fact, that has even been verified by these recent observations of the very early universe that Neil was talking about in the cosmic microwave background. So we now know, we believe with great confidence, we know how many protons and neutrons there are in the universe, but when we weigh galaxies and clusters of galaxies, they weigh 10 to 50 times more. And so we're driven to something beyond protons and neutrons, not just because we like the idea, but because it just doesn't seem possible to fill up the universe with protons and neutrons. Whereas a priori, that's the simplest, would have been the simplest, snowballs or you know, cosmologists or something that don't shine could have filled up the universe. But in fact, we think that it's really some new type of elementary particle. And that does make it interesting because that means it's in this room here now, with you all going right through your bodies as you're watching this.
Billions,
don't panic.
Billions passing through you per second.
Yeah. So. I actually want to bring up one little bit of insider baseball on this. I know that there has been a lot of controversy over one of the dark matter experiments in particular, the Italian one you referred to. Mm-hmm. It's called DAMA. Mm-hmm. There was some debate over whether what they were seeing was actually evidence for dark matter, whether it was noise in the system. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about how we know, again, when we see it. You need a lot of data before you can really make a definitive statement that you've seen evidence of this. So perhaps someone of you could describe what you're looking at and how you'll know.
Well, I think it was in 1986 or whatever that we pointed out that there's an annual modulation of the dark matter signal. So the signal is going to, you're going to get the largest number of counts in June and the lowest number of counts in December. And the reason for this is simply because the Earth is moving around the sun. So you get a variation in the number of counts in your detector. So the DAMA experiment sees this annual modulation. There's no other competition, so these other particles I was mentioning that come from the Earth's atmosphere, they're not going to have that annual modulation. So this is the only explanation, if it really is particle physics that you're seeing, the only explanation that we have is that it would be a dark matter particle. Now the problem is somewhat sociological, because when the data first came out, they had limited amounts of information. They had a few days in the summer and a month in the winter. But at this point, they have 8 years worth of data. It's statistically real, so they're seeing something. And I remember when the first indication of this effect was there, people said, oh, it's just radioactive contamination, or it's the temperature in Rome. And they've systematically gone through these things and showed, no, it's not. So they've done a good job on that. However, they're not letting other people look at their data, and that leads to suspicion and doubt. So we don't know if they really see something or not.
Well, there's another reason we're quite skeptical. First, we're quite skeptical, and that's good. And the other is that, annual modulation happens a lot on Earth. There are lots of things that modulate annually, and so there are lots of different ways to imagine something that would affect things annually. But the point that we should, that's really important, is there are lots of different experiments going on. And so many people have said, if they see this signal here, then we should see a signal in our detector, in a different kind of detector, and we haven't seen it. Now, mm-hmm. Does that rule it out completely? Well, it depends who's doing the analysis. I think it does, but some people might not. But the important thing is that it's very important in physics to have things confirmed. From a single experiment, you never really trust anything, and you want to have lots of different ways to measure something. So that when if you actually see something, you can test it, you can see if the idea is wrong, because really that's what you're trying to do, is to prove things wrong, because that's the only way you can really falsifying things is what science is all about. But also, if it's right, you can do different experiments to look for different aspects of it and trying to hone in on what type of particle it is. So right now, there are lots of experiments that are sort of in conflict with it, and that's why many people are skeptical about it. But it's important that we do lots of experiments, that we never just put all our eggs in one basket. That's even why in the Large Hadron Collider, the big accelerator that, as I said the other night, is going to, you know, create a black hole and destroy the Earth. But before that, it won't. But before that, it's going to hopefully tell us a lot about the fundamental structure of matter. But even in that experiment, or in that accelerator, there are a number of different experiments. Because if just one experiment measured things, we wouldn't trust it. We have to have different ways of measuring things to really do checks and balances in physics.
By the way, this is extremely exciting. I think when you look at the WIMP candidates, it's weakly interacting, and that means you can not only see it if it passes through the laboratory, but you can actually create it in the laboratory. And the Large Hadron Collider will be able to create these WIMP particles through most of the parameter range of the particles. And I think it could be nothing more convincing than to actually produce a dark matter particle at CERN, calculate its properties, and figure out, yes, it's just the right amount would have been produced in the Big Bang to explain the dark matter.
And then so it would give direction to the experimentalist to tell them exactly what type of detector to build to put underground to look for it.
Right. I the reason we're poised for a discovery is exactly because we have all these different avenues. Mm-hmm. So these underground experiments, the ones in space, the big accelerator at CERN, and it's beginning to look like more than one of them is seeing something.
If you can maybe tell us a little bit more about the one in space, I believe it's the Fermi telescope you're describing, or what is different about how they're looking for dark matter as opposed to how others are? How do they complement each other in their approaches?
Well, that one is looking for dark matter annihilation. So these weakly interacting massive particles are their own anti-partners, which means that whenever they encounter one another, they annihilate and turn into something else. It's a matter-antimatter annihilation. So they annihilate, and out comes neutrinos, electrons and positrons, but also photons, gamma rays. So these gamma rays is what the Fermi satellite is seeing when it looks towards the center of the galaxy. That's where you'd have the largest amount of dark matter in our galaxy, is near the center, and you have the annihilation, if this is the right particle, you have annihilation happening at the center of the galaxy with those photons coming towards the Fermi satellite.
And that's another thing to emphasize. Why are we talking about it now? It's a new window. We put up the Fermi satellite because we didn't have a very comprehensive gamma ray detector in space. And you know, whether or not this turns out to be dark matter, it's just an example of every time you put a new window up there, you're surprised. And so that's why we have to keep doing it. And so it's a very exciting new window because it's something we haven't had access to before. The gamma rays don't make it down to Earth, and so you need it up in space, and it's the first such satellite. And so, you know, it's early days, and we'll see what happens, but it's just an example of why we want to put new windows up there.
We've been speaking about how these things start off sometimes as almost sounding like science fiction and exotic states of matter. So we have Lawrence here, the author of The Physics of Star Trek, so I have to ask, you must have seen the new Star Trek movie with the red matter.
Yeah, with the red matter.
You got to talk about that for our audience.
Yeah. Well, I like this Star Trek movie. I didn't like the science in the Star Trek movie, but I liked the Star Trek movie. I thought the characters came out looking by the end just right. But but there are a lot of silly things, and red matter is one of them. But people ask me, why is it red matter? And it's because it's red. Because it's, you know, we talk about dark matter. Some people, you know, call black holes black matter. And so they needed something, a plot device that would do something. And the plot device is actually really silly. It's something that creates black holes when you put it in a planet, but not when it's just sitting there. So one of the many, you know, but you have to suspend disbelief, and there's a lot of disbelief. And once you suspend that, it's a kind of exciting, fun movie.
But I had to ask.
It's all right. I'm contractually obliged to mention it. So
okay. We only have a few minutes left, so I basically want to give each of you one last chance to talk about where we're going. I mean, are we done? Once we wrap up these last few remaining questions, are we done? Can we hang up the cosmology signs and just kind of go home? I mean, what happens after that? Are we ever done? And I guess we start with Neil and work our way down.
No, we're certainly never done. But I think even working within the field, we are amazed. All three of us, I'm sure, are absolutely amazed how far it's come. I know personally in 1990, I was quite frustrated with cosmology because it seemed there was so little data, so many opinions. It was very hard to decide anything. But then 1992, that completely changed when these maps of the early universe came out from the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite. So I think the progress of the subject is something we can't really anticipate. In my experience, the observers and experimentalists don't even understand their own capabilities. They will be doing things in 10 years which they cannot conceive of doing now. I mean, I made predictions in the mid-90s for the polarization of the microwave sky, and the experimentalists said this will never be measured, and yet 10 years later, they were measuring it. Mm-hmm. And so I think we, as theorists, our job is to continue thinking, you know, the deepest thoughts we can, try to make sense of the whole picture, and in everything we do, try to make it mathematically precise and logical and rigorous, and also get the predictions out of it, which will, you know, provoke our experimental colleagues to go and try and disprove us. And that's the way the science really progresses. But I think amazing things will happen over the next 10 to 20 years.
Katie?
Well, can I cheat a little bit?
Absolutely.
And I'm bursting with enthusiasm for my latest baby, which are dark stars. So I'm going to tell you about that.
Okay.
So if
I'm sorry, I totally forgot to ask you. You're absolutely right.
Well, so if the dark matter is indeed made of these WIMPs, then the WIMPs can power stars. Not today's stars, because the number of WIMPs inside there is too small, but the early stars, when the universe was about 200 million years old. It's that same annihilation that I was talking about for observing the gamma rays towards the center of the galaxy. Well, that same annihilation process would happen inside the first stars and power them. And in fact, I had to learn about stellar structure. So we made calculations for what these stars would look like. It's a new phase of stellar evolution that would last a million years at least, but possibly a billion years. And what I'm hoping for the next generation of telescopes is that these objects could be found. We're predicting they're about a million times as bright as the sun. They're very large, 1,000 times, maybe even a million times as massive as the sun. They're really different objects, supermassive objects. And the next generation of the space telescope, which is called the James Webb Space Telescope, has a possibility to observe these things, but we're talking about in the next decade or so. So I'm not answering the long-term question, but I'm just so excited that I had to tell you about this.
Excellent. That's
great. Okay, I'll go back to the issue and expand on what Neil said. Every time we make a new discovery, it always brings more questions, and so I don't think we're anywhere near the end. There may be observational difficulties, you know, there's so many fundamental puzzles, even if we just understand the nature of dark matter, and we may or may not in the next decade, the dark energy is such a deep problem that it'll take a lot longer, I think, to understand, because I think it's really tied to our understanding of the structure of space and probably quantum gravity, so there are just a whole host of open questions, and I expect that the questions we're asking 5 years from now will be ones we don't even know we're talking about the same, you know, party line here, but the discoveries that will be made will lead us to ask a whole set of new questions that we can't even fathom right now. But also, I want to temper it, and in fact, one of the fun things I hope to do tomorrow night is point out that even with all of the data one has and all the incredible theoretical edifice we have, we can come up with completely the wrong picture of the universe that's consistent with everything one can see. And I'll show, in fact, that in the far future, that's exactly what's going to happen.
Oh. How can we miss that? Let's thank our speakers. They're amazing. We're going to open things up for questions now. Again, please only ask one question and try and be brief. We'd like to squeeze as many as we can in, and we only have 15 minutes. There's a microphone right down here. Feel free to come on down. And I think we're going to start with a question from online. Jen?
Yes, I have a question from Michael from Mississauga, Ontario. He wants to know, does the rate of accumulating new knowledge in your field appear to be increasing over time in an exponential way? And if so, do you think the trend might continue?
Well, you know, we said last night predictions about the future, predictions are particularly difficult when they're about the future. I expressed a pessimistic view the other day, and I guess I'll express it now. I think we have been very fortunate in the last 20 years to accumulate this incredible amount of data. And Neil said it very well. I mean, the cosmic microwave background data is amazing, and that kind of wealth of data is probably not likely to be accumulated. So I think it's quite possible that this will slow down. And we could easily enter into cosmology, in the worst picture, into something that particle physics has experienced over the last 30 years with these models that are wonderful and explain all the data, but they're completely incomplete. We don't understand them, and there's no new data that can tell us between them. That's why we're so excited about the Large Hadron Collider. It's possible that all of the theories you've been hearing about could be hanging there waiting for new observations that don't come for another generation.
I'm not sure I agree with that, because we know the Large Hadron Collider is it'll start eventually. So that's coming online. Then I think we're going to learn a lot about the dark energy from a host of different experimental attacks, including the Joint Dark Energy Mission, which will be some kind of satellite that goes into space. So we'll learn a lot more about the dark energy that way, and we may also learn whether it's constant or time-dependent. Mm-hmm. That's a really big one. Mm-hmm. So I think, with the gravitational wave detectors turning on, I think there's going to be a lot of activity for the next couple of decades still. Beyond that, well, it also depends on funding, so we'll have to wait
and
see.
Okay, I'll bet you any amount of money that we won't learn anything about the dark energy and the dark energy mission, okay? We'll learn it's constant, which we know already, and it won't tell us anything. So, but we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah. But,
do you want to say? I think we have a bet going on right now. why don't we, unless you want to add something, we're going to next questioner.
You spoke about a rapid expansion of the universe somewhat closer to the speed of light, and then Lawrence said that it even could get faster. Has this expansion been at a steady, constant pace? And what are the implications of changing speeds? And if you could elaborate maybe a little bit more on faster than the speed of light.
Well, as far as, I mean, we didn't, when it was first observed, it wasn't quite certain, but all evidence suggests that the acceleration is a constant rate, which is exactly what you'd expect if the energy of empty space remained the same. It's all consistent with that, although actually that's not 100% true. There was a paper that came out just last week suggesting that there are hints that maybe that's not true, and you might need, as Katie said, variations in general relativity. So someone just proposed that a week or two ago. They've analyzed some data. You shouldn't get too excited at such things, but it's interesting. So what's really neat is when it was first observed, of course, there's lots of ways that things can get dimmer. It could get dimmer just because there's dust between us and those guys. There were lots of ways the data could have been wrong. Those things have been checked, and they're not wrong for that reason. Moreover, we've actually been able to see this. If the dark energy is what it is now, it was earlier much less important, as Neil said. And so earlier, the universe was decelerating, if that's true. And been able to probe to look back and actually see the time when the universe went from deceleration to acceleration. So everything is fitting, and that's good. That means that those observations are probably right. So we've actually been able to observe about 5 billion years ago, the universe went through what's called a cosmic jerk. I was very happy. I was actually revealed at a meeting that I ran, and we had Adam Riess, and I remember the New York Times had a picture of Adam Riess, and it said, "Cosmic jerk discovered." It's amazing that we can actually see that period go from deceleration to acceleration. Yeah. Now, let me elaborate on the going faster than the speed of light. It's true even in any universe, even one that isn't accelerating, that if it's big enough, there are regions that are moving away from us faster than the speed of light now, and there certainly will be in the future. The point is, in general relativity, you could be standing still and still moving at the same time. Locally, those objects are at rest, just like we are in their nearby surroundings. But globally, they're moving away from us because space is carrying them away from us. And what Einstein really told us is that things can't move through space faster than the speed of light, but space can do whatever the hell it wants.
Next question.
You mentioned earlier how you were excited for gravity wave detectors because the universe is transparent to these gravity waves and they give us a view of the early universe. But how do you detect something that is... The universe is transparent to. I mean, how do you build a detector that looks for something that, by hypothesis, goes through everything we know about?
So you have to be clever. And there are at least two ways we know how to detect them, one of which is already being done in space by the Planck satellite, which is currently flying. And the way that works is that we're receiving radiation from the early universe, from the microwave radiation, just ordinary light coming from the early universe. And if there's a gravitational wave in the universe, what it does is it squeezes space. Say it's coming straight at us. It squeezes space in one direction and stretches it in another. And that causes the light scattering off the surface of the plasma coming to us to be polarized one way rather than the other. And so if you map the polarization of the sky, there's a certain pattern called a curl pattern that the polarization would actually have some curl present if there are gravitational waves. And so this is a way, in fact, using the entire universe as a giant detector of gravitational waves. So that's one promising idea, and in fact Stephen Hawking has bet that the Planck satellite will detect gravitational waves from inflation due to this mechanism. So there's a very precise statement being made. The other way to do it is to directly see the gravitational waves, shorter wavelength, not wavelength as big as the universe, but some plausibly measurable scale. And so one of the ideas is to put a big antenna in space called a large interferometric space antenna, which is three satellites separated by, I think, about 1 million kilometers each. And so these form a big triangle, and across this triangle you send laser beams, which are just measuring the distance of these satellites from each other all the time. And if a gravitational wave passes through, then the distance between these satellites changes. And that distance change will be an indication of a gravitational wave. There's even a design now for a satellite system about 20 years from now called the Big Bang Observer. And that's specifically designed to see gravitational waves from the Big Bang.
We should add that, this is amazing technology, what people can do, that there are already terrestrial gravitational wave detectors based on interferometry called LIGO, and there are others around the world, that are based on looking at light going in two different directions. And if a gravitational wave goes through, as Neil just said, it will literally change the distance between two points. But what is amazing is that these things are several miles long, and they're designed to measure a change in distance much smaller than the size of a single atomic nucleus. And they can do it. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, that is. Next question.
Theoretically, is there any possibility that there are other universes and that the Big Bang singularity is actually more like a window and that the matter that came in through that is much like how a laser works, where matter has to create enough energy to escape out, and then it would explain the initial jet and then a deceleration and then another acceleration?
Yeah, this is an idea I actually like very much, that the singularity is in fact a selection mechanism
that the universe somehow heads towards a singularity, but only if it's in the right configuration does it get through and get to make the next Big Bang. Because I think we've learned one thing from string theory so far, with our current about string theory, not about the world.
Okay, okay.
The one thing that seems to have emerged from string theory is that it's not predictive. It doesn't predict the precise laws of physics. In fact, it gives rise to a huge number of possible laws of physics. They all seem to be on the same footing within the theory. And there's at least 10 to the power 1,000 possibilities for the different for the sets of laws of physics. So it's not, on its own, it's not predictive. However, my thought is that describing the singularity itself may tell us which of that particular set is actually realized in nature. We need more information. We need more constraints to select that. Other people's ideas are this, like the anthropic principle, which is the idea that all these universes exist somewhere, but we just happen to be in the one that allows us to live. We can get into this. I think this is not a very scientific idea, because we can't see the other universes. But anyway, that's the alternative. Yep.
Next question.
At the Big Bang, did the singularity, was it existing in space, or is space one of the things that was rolled up in the singularity?
So, again, if I can comment, sure. The most dramatic development in theory, in theoretical physics of this type, fundamental theoretical physics, over the last 10 years, has been a concept called holography. And this is the realization that, in some ways, space is not a fundamental entity. That we've learned that in some situations, you can have a region of space which is surrounded by a boundary, the surface, if you like, the surface of a box. And what goes on inside the region, for example, forming a black hole or some violent gravitational effect, is described in a completely equivalent manner by physics on the surface of that region of space. And that physics on the surface doesn't involve gravity at all. So this is an amazing discovery that gravity, which was thought to be the most puzzling and weird of the forces, because it creates these singularities, is in fact equivalent to a theory which has no gravity at all, and in fact is a rather conventional type of theory called a quantum field theory. And so what we've learned from this is that it's an indication that space indeed is not a fundamental thing. There's an equivalent description which involves at least one less dimension of space. You can describe everything happening in 3D with a 2D picture. That's why it's called holography, because a hologram is a 2D picture of a 3D object. And so that's very exciting. So space, I think most theorists now working on this believe that space is an emergent concept. It's not a fundamental entity. And this is very exciting in terms of describing the singularity, because the singularity at the beginning of the universe was the moment when all of space shrank to zero size. That sounds indescribable, but if space isn't fundamental, well, you just switch to this alternative description. And so even if space went away, you have the alternative. And so some of us are trying to use this holographic framework to understand the Big Bang singularity itself. Now, time is a whole different story. Time is something much more fundamental to physics than space. If you have no time, where's physics? You can't predict how things change. What is a law when there's no time? And so it's quite possible that space is not fundamental, but time still is. The alternative is that neither are fundamental, but we don't really have any good models of both disappearing.
Right. Well, let's thank our speakers one more time. I hope you've all been edified. I personally have learned a lot, heard some great things here tonight. I've been asked to remind you to please exit to your right, just so we can do this orderly and quickly, and also to remind you that if you want to buy any of their books, you can do so in the bookstore in the atrium. Thank you for coming. Yeah.